Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the CJP Me Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. In a major legal victory against Canada's trade with illegal Israeli settlements in occupied Palestinian territory, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has ruled that labeling goods from those settlements as product of Israel would be false and that such labels violate Canadian consumer protection law. In other words, it is unlawful for goods from illegal settlements to be labeled as if they are Israeli. Today, we are joined by David Kadenberg and lawyer Dimitri Lascaris, who have led this multi-year legal battle against Settlement Wine. We talk about what this legal decision means, the challenges ahead to get accurate labeling, and the importance of ending trade with illegal settlements altogether. My name is Michael Biekert, Vice President of CJPME and the podcast host for today. I am excited to be joined today by two guests. David Kadenberg is a web publisher, storyteller, and university lecturer currently living in the Netherlands. In 2017, while in Winnipeg, he launched the initial complaint into the settlement wines, which were falsely labeled as product of Israel, and has been fighting Canada in court since then. Representing him in that case is Dimitri Lascaris, who is also joining us today. Dimitri is an award-winning class actions lawyer who in 2020 ran a campaign for leadership of the Green Party of Canada, coming in a very close second place out of eight candidates. He's also the former chair of the board of CJPME. Welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here, Michael.
Hello.
So very excited to have you here to talk about this this latest development with the Settlement Wines case. But why don't we start at the beginning? David, can you tell us a little bit about your initial complaint in 2017? What was the issue that you saw with the wine labels?
Well, it's a long, long story, Michael. It's been going on for 5 years. It started in January of
2017 when I was I spotted a pair of obvious settlement wines at the website of the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. One was produced by Sagot Winery, which is obviously associated with Sagot Settlement. And the other one was Shiloh, a Shiloh product associated with Shiloh Settlement. I very quickly established that both were almost certainly produced from juice that had come 100% from grapes grown in the occupied Palestinian territories. So I sent a complaint to the Liquor Control Board of Ontario with a CC to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. And, you know, to make a long story short, Canadian Food Inspection Agency would actually receive that complaint right at the start. It received that in January of 2017. And I said, you know, these are falsely labeled. They say they're products of Israel and they're actually products of the occupied Palestinian territory of settlements. This really angered me because what the label meant to me was that Israel was claiming sovereignty over stolen Palestinian land on Canadian store shelves, achieving effective annexation of the territory without actually doing it by simply claiming this is Israeli and the Canadian government endorsing annexation, which right. is a grave crime.
And it's counter to Canadian foreign policy as well. Canada doesn't recognize Israel's permanent control over that territories, and yet is giving these products from those settlements, this product of label, a product of Israel label. That makes no sense.
Yeah, I mean, Canada acknowledges at its website that the settlements are illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention. It knows that the breach is Article 49.6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is classified as a grave breach under the 1977 Protocol Additional and is incorporated into the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court as a war crime. So the ICC has never ruled on Israel's settlements, so we say its settlements are presumptive war crime. But, you know, transferring your population into occupied territory, effectively colonizing it, constitutes a war crime. And Canada knows that completely. And so this was shocking. So it took the CFIA spent 6 months arriving at a determination. I know for a fact that over 200 CFIA officials, staff members and staff of Global Affairs Canada and various other government staff, something like 250 of them, were involved in the six-month process arriving at a determination that product of Israel labels were not, did not comply with federal statutes. They never informed me of that decision. I learned about it from a B'nai B'rith Canada Facebook post.
Which is a pro-Israel group in Canada.
Yeah, so they informed the Liquor Control Board of Ontario of this of their determination on July 6th, 2017. And then the word got out. And basically within a period of the government of Israel complained to the Canadian government. And of course, B'nai B'rith Canada and Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs complained. And we know that one sitting member of parliament at the time, Michael Levitt, was also actively involved in going right up to the top, complaining to the Trudeau government. And the Trudeau government pressured the CFIA intensively. We know that the pressure came right from the very, very top, from the Privy Council office itself. And the person who was conveying the message to the president of the CFIA was the deputy minister of foreign affairs, who would end up becoming, if I'm not mistaken, ambassador to China. So a senior political appointee pressuring the CFIA to reverse its decision, which it did within a business day, basically. So a decision that was arrived at through extensive research and exercise of due diligence and professionalism, 6 months. They flip-flopped in a business day to satisfy the lobby. So effectively, what the Canadian government did was strong arm a Canadian federal agency to waive enforcement of federal statutes on behalf of a foreign country and under pressure from the lobbyists of that foreign country, which blows my mind. I mean, this was, I think, amongst the most egregious political scandals in modern political history in Canada. Shortly after that flip-flop, Dmitry, I contacted Dmitry, who at that time was just an acquaintance, would become a good friend, and my attorney. He took the case up pro bono, filed an appeal to the Complaints and Appeals Office of the CFIA. The CFIA rejected the appeal at the end of September of 2017, at which point Dmitry filed a notice of application to the federal court, and I'll let you continue, Dmitry.
Yeah, Dmitry, why don't you tell us a bit about what you thought of the case when you were asked to take this on, and what happened from there?
I completely agree with David's assessment of the scandalous nature of what happened. I mean, it's bad enough that the complainant, David was the complainant. There was nobody else going to the CFIA making submissions for or against these labels, just David. They make a decision after 6 months, thanks to David's persistence and his eloquent advocacy, and he wasn't represented by a lawyer, and they don't even tell him. They then communicate the decision to the LCBO. Somebody to this very day, we don't know who, leaks the decision of the CFIA, which had been non-publicly communicated to the LCBO, to B'nai B'rith and the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. Before David even knows that the decision's been rendered in his favor, they have begun to apply intense pressure on the Trudeau government, which immediately transfers that pressure onto the head of the CFIA at the time, Paul Glover. How do we know this? Because as part of a judicial review application, the regulatory agency has to produce all of its internal documentation relating to its decision. So we found out through, scrupulous examination of this documentation, exactly what had transpired. And it was undoubtedly a case of just naked political pressure, forcing a regulatory agency, which had taken 6 months, had consulted people from around the country who were specialists in these sort of things, had received advice from Global Affairs Canada about the legal status of the West Bank, about Canada's foreign policy with respect to the West Bank. And like that, on a dime, they changed their minds, purely due to political pressure. And so at that point, we had to go to court.
And just to stop here, just quick, the reason that they reversed it, obviously they didn't say, well, it's political interference, right? It's like, oh, the government would prefer it be different. There was an argument that, they had forgotten to take into account the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement, right? Was that the argument?
Yeah, and it was worse than a specious argument. It was cooked up, because I learned that in the course of its original initial determination, consultations had taken place with Global Affairs Canada, between the CFIA and Global Affairs Canada, and the smartest of the smartest expert, mid-level but true expert trade officials at Global Affairs Canada said, obviously looked at the Canada-Israel Free Trade Agreement and scratched their heads and said, CIFTA doesn't say anything about settlements. They scrutinized the framing agreement. I won't go into the details because it's really down into the weed stuff, but they told CFIA officials, forget about CIFTA. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it. Just base yourself on your own statutes, the Food and Drug Act and the Consumer Packaging and Labeling Act. And when the proverbial material hit the fan, and the Trudeau government right at the very top, this was Ian Sugars, by the way, is the name of the man, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ian Sugars, who actually is now clerk of the Privy Council, right? So he's a senior official, and he was senior back then, said, just go use CIFTA, because CIFTA extends Israel's extended customs area, captures the West Bank. We know that the settlements in the West Bank So just talk about the West Bank. Israel's customs area includes the West Bank, knowing as I know they did, that senior like trade specialists had told the CFIA, no, actually, SIFTA's got nothing to do with it. So they reverse engineered it. They just cooked up the SIFTA argument. And actually, you know, in the course of modernizing SIFTA, it's kind of astonishing. Another senior trade official went before the Canadian Senate and said, number one, settlements are illegal. Yes, Canada's policy is that settlements are illegal. And number two, yes, SIFTA extends trade benefits to the settlements.
But to add to you know, to what David said, not only did the SIFTA not say anything about settlements, it doesn't say anything about labels. It has right. nothing to do with labeling at all. And, you know, what it has to do with is we explained, even before we went to court, as soon as we saw this explanation, we said to the CFIA, after an exhaustive review of this voluminous trade agreement, there's nothing in here about labels. What this is about very clearly is trade barriers. So the classic trade barrier is a tariff. Saying that a product has to be accurately labeled is not a trade barrier. You can still bring it in the country. You're not charging people more for it. You're not applying any additional cost to it. You're just giving them information about where it actually came from. So this argument, when we got to the Federal Court of Appeal, I think absolutely got no traction whatsoever. It got no traction in the lower court either. And I think, you know, really, we won it hands down at the Federal Court of Canada. And the judge who presided over that decision was not only the former chairperson of the Canadian Human Rights Commission, which I think was very helpful to her understanding the issues, but she was then elevated after the decision to the Federal Court of Appeal. In the interim, in between the time she rendered the decision, the time she was elevated to the Federal Court of Appeal, Botich, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but Botich Shmuley.
Shmuley Botich,
who is, as I'm sure both of you know, a highly outspoken and aggressive advocate for Israel, took out a full page ad in the New York Times accusing this judge of being an anti-Semite. I'd never seen any, all of my career, I had never seen any litigant for any reason attack a judge in that way. Whether, you know, by false accusations of anti-Semitism or in any other character aspersion. It was absolutely unprecedented. So we got up to the Federal Court of Appeal, and you know, when the judge who was the president of that three-judge panel was the president, was the chief justice of the Federal Court of Appeal. Again, we got, you know, some heavyweights to consider this case. Based upon oral argument, when we finished speaking, but before the court rendered its decision, I was sure we were going to win outright, because the questions of the court were entirely hostile to the attorney general, and I thought very receptive to our argument. But the judges came back after deliberating and delivered a decision from the bench, which was a bit of a surprise. They dismissed the appeal, but what they said was, effectively, we're going to give the CFIA another chance to explain itself, because its explanation is completely inadequate. Mm-hmm. It simply will not fly. So we're going to ask these litigants, and by this point in time, Sago had entered the litigation, Sago Winery, to submit, make further submissions to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency in writing, and then the CFIA will render its decision. It can disregard the decision of the Federal Court of Canada. It can make the same decision as it made last time. It can make a different decision, but whatever it does, it's going to have to explain itself very carefully and cogently. And so at this point, my own prediction was, because of the strong antipathy of both levels of court to the decision, that the CFIA was going to go back to its original decision. And it did. You know, the key element of this decision is the fine print. And, you know, David and I have been having a lot of discussions about this. Let me say at the outset, I've read the decision several times. I do believe it is a major victory for the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in Canada. The CFIA has now said unequivocally that a product of Israel label standing alone, those are the operative words, standing alone, is a violation of the Canadian consumer protection laws if it's coming from a settlement. What the CFIA has not told us is what more needs to be said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I have no doubt, and we've already seen confirmation of this in comments that the lawyer for Psego made to the Canadian Jewish News in the last couple of days, that the settlement producers, and particularly Psego, because you know, the CEO of Psego, Yaakov Berg, is very aggressive. He ran up a case all the way to the European Court of Justice, contrary to advice he was receiving from people in the Israeli government, because they were concerned he was going to lose and he was going to establish a negative precedent for settlement producers. And he did just that. So he's very aggressive. And I think he's going to read this decision in a manner that is as favorable as possible to him. And he's going to come back into Canada with these wines, and they're going to still say product of Israel on them. And he's going to add some little language in small letters somewhere. Maybe it'll be something like territory administered from Israel, by Israel. Maybe it'll be, you know, David came up with one possible idea, you know, the indigenous land of the Jewish people, something like that. Our position is very clear. We've said it unequivocally, and we will litigate if they do not enforce this. The label must, at a bare minimum, state that it is coming from, the product is coming from occupied Palestinian territory, and secondly, that it is coming from a settlement.
Right.
Because only then will the Canadian consumer know that they are being asked to purchase a product that is the fruit of a crime, because that's what these are. These are the fruits of a war crime. If you don't tell them that much, then they don't know that they are being asked to put their hard-earned money into a fruit of a war crime. So we'll have to see what happens next. And you know, it may be that other settlement producers take a different approach, a less aggressive approach. You may have a variety of responses from settlements that are importing food products and beverages into Canada. Some of them may be, at the end of the day, something we can live with. Others may not be, but we're going to have to challenge whatever they do if it doesn't meet those minimal requirements. And then it's going to be up to the CFIA to decide what does actually satisfy Canadian law. Right now, right. It's told us what doesn't satisfy Canadian law. It hasn't told us what does satisfy Canadian law.
Right. So throughout this process, I mean, David, you were essentially vindicated eventually, well, multiple times. You had your complaint like, this is false. They review it for many months. They make a decision. Yeah, it's false. We can't have these labels. It's immediately overturned by the Canadian government. So you go to court, the judge finds, yes, you know, these labels, they're not just false, but they're also misleading and deceptive.
And an infringement, and the federal court judge ruled false, misleading, and deceptive, and accepting an argument that was put forward by Barb Jackman on behalf of Independent Jewish Voices, and an infringement of the Canadian Charter guaranteed right of free speech, understanding conscientious consumer choices as being a form of free speech. And so right. Falsely labeling a wine essentially hinders conscientious consumer choices, which is charter guaranteed. And the Federal Court of Canada upheld that. And it's while the Federal Court of Appeal didn't opine on that, they said, well, the CFIA can make a decision, you know, consider that charter rights apply or not. Mm-hmm. And what the Canadian Food Inspection Agency said, which is very interesting, is they said, first of all, the charter doesn't apply to this case. But having said that, they said that this is a quote from the CFIA ruling, consumer choice in selecting a wine remains unrestricted by the government, allowing consumers to continue to act in line with their conscience. So the CFIA has effectively upheld the concept that consumers make conscientious decisions, mm-hmm. decisions based on their conscience, not simply, is this the right alcohol content? Or, you know, is this the whatever? It's they're basing their decisions based on ethical, political, social conscience, which right. is, I think, groundbreaking.
So
if that's true, if that's true, then Canadians have the right to see on a label that something was produced in occupied territory. That's the term that Canada uses and the international community uses, and occupied territory settlements are illegal. They have the right to know this was produced in a settlement. That's what they're called. That's what the government of Canada calls them. And they're illegal. They constitute a war crime. Conscientious consumers have the right to know it.
Right. Not just to know that, but if someone wanted to boycott settlement goods, that act would itself fall under this sort of the right to free expression on this matters. And so
So the CFIA is tacitly saying, acknowledging the right of consumers to boycott. And Justice McTavish, the Honorable Justice McTavish of the federal court, actually referred to boycotts in her decision. She said, people boycott products based on their conscience. Of course, she did not mention BDS, but she talked about consumer boycotts and suggested that these are completely legitimate, and that false labels hinder that charter guaranteed right. So it's all very interesting.
Maybe I just add something, Michael, about this, which is really important for people to understand, because what happened here has implications that go way beyond even Israel. The Attorney General, David Lametti, who is, formerly the opponent in this case, was so desperate to prevent David's victory from prevailing that the Ministry of Justice actually took the position that Canada's consumer protection laws do not protect conscientious behavior by consumers. So when we were in front of Justice McTavish, the former chairperson of the Canadian Human Rights Commission, we said, just think about the implications of this, what they're telling you. Let's suppose you're an animal rights activist and they're telling you that some meat product you're about to buy was produced from a farm which treats animals humanely and ethically. And in fact, it comes from a factory farm which treats them with sadism and the utmost brutality. And you buy the product thinking it's not unhealthy for you, but you buy the product thinking that it was produced in a humane manner. And then you find out the truth. According to the Attorney General, you have no basis to complain under our consumer protection laws. Or imagine somebody who is concerned about the climate crisis and they buy a product thinking it was produced in a way that minimizes emissions, but in fact it was produced in a way that is extremely polluting, but it doesn't actually harm them when they ingest it. They have no remedy under Canada's consumer protection laws, according to the Attorney General. This was a draconian proposition, which would have had dramatic implications for consumer behavior and for the remedies available to consumers under Canadian consumer protection law. And thankfully, Justice McTavish rejected it. And it appears that the CFIA is now embracing that principle, that in fact, the Canadian consumer protection laws do protect the behavior, conscientious behaviors by consumers. So this what David has done is going to have beneficial effects well outside of the context of, Palestinian solidarity.
Mm. Wow. And I guess we should talk a bit more about maybe there's some ambiguity about the latest decision, because although it does say that these labels are false, it is being interpreted in very different ways. So we've talked about how, and in your statement, but because these are false and it violates all of this different consumer protection law, it basically means that these labels are unlawful. And this does affirm the view that it's false and unlawful to portray goods coming from settlements as if they are a product of Israel. On the other side, the groups who have been advocating for there to be no distinction for these goods to be labeled just product of Israel, the groups that are supportive of goods from illegal settlements, they're trying to spin this as a failure for you, saying that your objectives have not been met in this, and that actually they're saying, oh, we're going to come back, Dimitri, as you suggested, they're going to try to come back with language later, because this decision, it didn't say what the rulings, what the labels going forward need to be, but it will have this consultation process. It's being interpreted as, oh, maybe we can say, yeah, it's provide clarification. It's not just a product of Israel. Maybe it's produced in Israeli territory, but maybe they can write it in a way that's pro-settlement still. What is your take on that interpretation that they're trying to push?
Well, I think we're not propagandists. So when we put out our statement, David and I, we were quite candid about what we saw as good and bad in this decision. We have a clear, unequivocal statement that a product of Israel label standing alone is a violation of Canadian consumer protection law. It's affixed to a settlement product. But the language of the decision leaves open the critical question. That's one critical question. The other critical question is, what more do you have to say? And so we were frank about that, and we wanted to send a clear signal to the government that we ain't going away. And we will be vigilant in ensuring at the next step of this process that all material information is disclosed to consumers. The reaction of, you know, Sago is a propagandistic reaction, which is to say, oh, look, there's nothing in this decision we don't like. It's a victory, a complete victory for us. It's just being intellectually dishonest. If it was a complete victory for them, then why didn't we see statements from B'nai B'rith and the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs and, you know, the Friends of Seaman Wiesenthal Centers, you know, the most outspoken proponents in the advocacy community for the state of Israel in Canada? Why didn't we see them crowing about this decision? There was complete and utter silence, nothing. There were no op-eds in the National Post about what a wonderful decision this was. The only time we heard any kind of a response, at least as far as I could tell, was when the Canadian Jewish News went to the lawyer for Psego and asked for comment. At that point, he was forced with a decision. Am I going to ignore this guy or am I going to say something? And he decided to say something, which was, in my view, propagandistic. It simply is not a reflection of the reality of the decision.
Right. And I guess one thing, I mean, maybe we should talk more about what labels should look like, because on one hand, clarification, even any level of clarification, is a blow to the settlement industry, because the goal of Israel and the settlements and groups like the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, all of these people, their goal is to erase the distinction between Israel and the settlements so that you cannot tell that there's a difference. Effectively annex the territory through our trade policy. And any indication that separates settlement goods from Israel, even no matter how bland that language is a blow to that attempt to treat the territory as annexed. At least, do you agree with that?
They're making the product of Israel by itself or in conjunction with some statement that's evasive or deceptive. Product of Israel is a false claim. It's a claim. It's a claim that settlements are sitting on Israeli land. This is the ancient ancestral homeland of the Jewish people. That's the claim. That's the claim, and it's a political claim. It's a religious claim, and labels. The purpose of a label is not to make a political or a religious claim. It's to state the origin, geographically speaking, of a wine. Well, a settlement is not Israeli, right? And to say that it's Israeli product of Israel, Israeli administered land, is to say it's Israeli administered would be a deception. It's actually Israeli occupied. It's not.
I totally agree with that, with what David just said. But just to answer your question directly, Michael, you're 100% correct. Okay. The fact of the matter is, and this is why it's a loss for their side, the labels on products that are coming from the settlements will no longer look the same as the labels from products made within the internationally recognized boundaries of Israel. And that's exactly what they want. They want to erase any and all distinctions between those two products, between the way we in the West treat those two pieces of land. And they now cannot do that. They can't erase the distinction. If this decision stands, the labels will look different. It's just a question of how different they're going to look and how directly they're going to notify consumers to the fact that these products are the fruits of a war crime.
Mm-hmm. And certainly
product of Israel is false. Mm-hmm. Of course, product of Israel is false, as the CFIA has just said, confirming what the federal court of appeal and the lower federal court said. Product of Israel is false. A product of Israeli administered territory is deceptive. Mm-hmm. That's deceptive labeling because it's anodyne. I mean, what does that mean? Nobody talks about Israeli administered territory. The correct term is Israeli occupied territory. And Israeli occupied Palestinian territory. Mm-hmm. That's not a political statement. It's a factual, universally accepted phrase. The Canadian government uses it. Anything short of product of settlement or Israeli occupied territory wouldn't be false, but it would be deceptive and misleading.
Mm. And I think
we won't accept it.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think it's, yeah, obviously going forward, any labels would have to demand that they accurately define these goods as coming not just from Israeli administered territory, whatever, but from settlements specifically, describe the context of occupation in some way. That's really key. The other side of it, though, is there's a danger maybe of having a catch-all term, labels for any goods from the occupied Palestinian territories. Or, for example, let's say they put the label West Bank on these goods because they're produced in the occupied West Bank. That would also be an awful outcome because then it doesn't distinguish from goods that are coming from indigenous Palestinian businesses. And if
well, the simplest solution, the simplest, most economical solution labeling wise is product of West Bank and then in parentheses Palestinian and product of West Bank parentheses Israeli settlement.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's something that we just need to make sure to insist on, that there's a distinction always made between illegal businesses in that territory and legitimate and indigenous businesses in that territory. And I think the difficulty in making that distinction points to the problem of occupation and apartheid, two legal systems, two regimes within the same a territorial space, and Canada's really inability to distinguish between those and to treat them fairly. What do you think we should do in the meantime? Obviously, there's consultation going to be happening at the end of this year, I think you said in your statement. Currently, we presumably these goods are still on the shelves with their product of label stickers that are now, you know, these are deemed false. What should we do in the meantime?
I think that all those wines, all Israeli wines, every last bottle of wine that says product of Israel on it is potentially a settlement wine. And I think that Canadians of conscience need to demand, to complain to the CFIA and to their liquor outlets and demand that the liquor outlets do the due diligence to establish whether or not these are indeed produced inside the green line. And until that due diligence happens, the wine products have to come off the shelves in accordance with the CFIA ruling the product of Israel is false. And who knows what percentage of all those wines come from settlements? Have to come off.
I would not, we shouldn't be limiting our efforts to identify products from occupied territory to wines.
Right.
Nor should we limit it to beverages. So if you go into a grocery store and you have reason to believe, even if you're not entirely sure, but you have some reason to believe that some fruit product that has a product of Israel label on it is in fact coming from a settlement, whether it's in the West Bank or the Golan Heights, you should send a letter to the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and complain about it, citing this decision. And David and I have put out a tweet, in fact, with a link to the CFIA email address to which you should send your complaint. And we can even, we're planning on putting together a form letter. And so again, this is cost-free, right? So if you end up being wrong, you have reason to think it's coming from occupied territory. It's a settlement product, but it turns out, because sometimes it's not clear, right? And it turns out you're wrong. There's no cost to you other than the time you spend to fill out this form letter and send it to the CFIA. They'll just come back after consulting with the importer until you know, in fact, it was produced within the internationally recognized boundaries of Israel, and that's fine. So I think we should be, frankly, inundating the regulator with complaints about any products which we have reason to believe are coming from settlements but are labeled as product of Israel.
And as far as the wine products are concerned, of course, I agree with Dimitri, the dates and all the other products. But as far as wines are concerned, the Liquor Control Board of Ontario is the largest, as I understand it, a liquor retailer in the world. The complaints, they go to the LCBO, deluge the LCBO with complaints about products that say product of Israel on them. And people need to present copies of the CFIA determination. We believe that the CFIA has actually informed the LCBO and other Canadian liquor retailers about this redetermination. We're now in the process of confirming this, but people should take this redetermination and take it to their liquor outlet, wherever they are across Canada, and say, take that wine off your shelf. It says product of Israel on it. It's false. We believe it's false.
What about the issue more broadly of trade with settlements in general? Because I think we all agree that the ultimate goal is not just having proper labeling, but that Canadian business with the settlements at all is a significant problem. What do you think we should do about that?
Well, let's be clear how morally bankrupt our government's policy is. It's telling us on the one hand, because the entire international community virtually is in agreement with this, as was every single judge of the International Court of Justice, that Israel does not exercise permanent control or sovereignty over the West Bank and that the settlements violate the Fourth Geneva Convention. And at the same time, it is not only allowing these products into Canada to be sold, it is not only, up until this decision, allowing them to be sold with false labels, it is conferring upon them preferential tariff treatment. I mean, you can hardly imagine a more stark and unconscionable contradiction between international law, even the government's own stated foreign policy, and what the government is doing in practice. So this is not a defensible position by any stretch of the imagination. So we need to up the game now. And what we want to do, and we're convening a group of lawyers, David is doing a lot of work to help organize us into a cohesive group from around the country, to examine whether the Geneva Conventions Act or some other piece of federal legislation could form the basis for legal action to, at a minimum, get a Canadian court to declare the importation of these products to be a violation of Canadian law. Whether we can get a court to actually prohibit their importation, that's a bigger challenge. But if we can at least get a declaration that this is a violation, then that's going to put the, you know, box the government into a corner. How is it going to ignore a declaration from a court of the obvious illegality of what the government is doing with these products? So I think that's where we're heading now. I mean, obviously, the reason why we thought this battle was worth fighting was that so people could have the information they need to effectively boycott these settlements, right? And the ultimate goal is to stop these things from being sold in Canada.
Right.
So that would be fully in accordance with, right? Canada is obliged under Article 25 of the United Nations Charter to abide by UN Security Council resolutions.
Right.
UN Security Council Resolution 2334 in December 2016 called on member states to differentiate between Israel proper and the settlements and their dealings with Israel. So Canada is obliged under Article 25 of the Charter. Article 1 of the Fourth Geneva Convention requires countries, state parties like Canada, to respect and ensure respect for the convention in all circumstances. Canada publicly acknowledges that Israel's settlements violate the Fourth Geneva Convention, and yet it welcomes settlement products into Canada and extends preferential tariff treatment to them. It's astonishing. And so, you know, who knows how these things will prosper in the courts, but simply by pursuing them raises lots of attention. It would be wonderful if the Canadian media reported on it. And this is very sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
That the Canadian media doesn't, I mean, other than Canadian press and, amusingly enough, Canadian Jewish news, nobody has reported on this case of mine over the past 5 years more consistently, more professionally, than Canadian Jewish news, remarkably. And CP hasn't done a bad job, but the CBC, Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, they don't have the slightest bit of interest in this.
Mm.
And actually CBC network, political and network programs have declared that they have no interest in reporting on the CFIA's decision.
Well, the other level, there's a legal route that I look forward to hearing a lot more about in the future. Certainly having media pay attention to this would really help. I also think we need to see action from parliamentarians to try to do something about this. I know that there are a number of different initiatives in Europe underway, various bills that have passed or been debated in Ireland or Finland to ban the importation of settlement goods. The European Union has ruled that that settlement goods, that the goods from settlements can't be labeled as product of Israel. And there's a campaign underway to try to get the EU to make a legal option available for banning the import from settlement goods entirely. So there are things happening right now that we can look to. We just need, one of the many things we need to do is to push parliamentarians to actually take this up and to talk about this, how Canadian trade policy is enabling violations of international law, and it's totally unacceptable. So I guess...
And it would be great, yeah. It would be fabulous. I mean, to talk about diving into the weeds, but it would be great if Foreign Affairs, Global Affairs Canada could be prevailed upon to declare that actually settlements, CIFTA does not extend trade benefits and favors to the settlements. Settlements are not part of the CIFTA deal because they're not. And I could go to some length in explaining why settlements are not covered under CIFTA, because they're not. And trade officials at Global Affairs Canada, they know it. They know this is true, and it's only because senior officials in the Canadian government and the politicians and government are just dead set on being best friends with Israel and its settlement enterprise. But that would be something kind of interesting to pursue in Parliament, to try to get CIFTA to be modified. Absolutely. To express that explicitly.
Absolutely. This is something that we're definitely going to have to work on a lot of different fronts in the next little while. But thanks so much for joining us today to talk about the latest legal victory and some of the sort of the problems that it poses for the future. Any last words before we end our conversation?
From my end, simply, you know, we appreciate very much all of the support from CJPME, and I know that CJPME has been out there doing everything it can to draw attention to this, and we look forward to continuing to work with you to accomplish even greater victories in terms of settlement products in the future. Thanks very much, Michael.
And Dimitri Lascaris has been fighting this fight, putting in countless, incalculable number of hours over the past 5 years. And so if I was wearing a hat, I'd tip it to Dimitri Lascaris, who is a champion, a true champion. It has to be acknowledged.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much. And we'll definitely check in the future when there's future developments on this.
Okay, take care.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find our program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped make this podcast possible. Thanks to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. And thanks to all of our listeners. We look forward to having you with us for our next podcast. Take care. See you soon.
The loss of Shireen Abu Akleh was not just a loss of a Palestinian voice or a Palestinian journalist. It was a loss of the voice of truth.
She was the voice of the voiceless Palestinian people. We saw Palestine from her camera. We listened to the stories of the Palestinian people. She was a magnificent human being, and we are in mourning.
Many girls and boys used to stand in front of mirrors and hold like a remote control or a comp and trying to pretend they are Shireen Abu Akleh and saying, from Palestine or from Jerusalem, I'm Shireen Abu Akleh.
In the city of Jenin, where Shireen Abu Akleh was killed, I think being here like thousands of miles away, to some extent makes us a little bit numb with the business of life and everything that's happening around us. But that day, all of the numbness kind of woke up only to realize that someone I didn't know meant so much to me was lost, was killed. Her loss is not a loss of a person. It's a loss of a collective memory that we all have of her, of her voice, and of Palestine.
I think Shireen Abu Aqla was a dangerous woman for them. Her existence threatened the occupation existence, and her voice exposed their crimes. There's an Egyptian feminist called Nawal Sa'dawi says that the truth is savage and dangerous. And I believe Shireen was showing, she was savage and dangerous. She was showing the truth and the ugly face of occupation, colonialism, apartheid, and the daily struggle of Palestinian people. And for that, she was killed.
It's the 74th anniversary of Nakba. Nakba in Arabic means catastrophe. It is the catastrophe of the Palestinian people who were scared and forcibly pushed out of their homes and also killed in massacres in several villages in 1948. But it wasn't the only thing. People only mention maybe that date, but Nakba kept happening year after year, slowly and quickly in daily life and in big wars, until this moment, until what happened to Shireen.
I wanted to create an intimate and small space for me and my friends and the Palestinian community that I know here, for us to come together and show and express our grief and pain for the loss of a Palestinian icon, and not only losing Shireen Abu Aqla, but losing a part of our memory of Palestine, of her, and the reminder that, you know, everything that we've lived at home is still happening. I was very positively overwhelmed by the amount of support and empathy that the New York and Brooklyn community showed. And just for them to show up today, knowing and not knowing who I am, knowing and not knowing who Shireen Abu Aqla was, their presence made the sadness and the grief a little bit lighter.
I'm extremely sad. I can't find a word to express my my sadness losing this huge icon. By killing her, they are sending a message to all of us that, like, the voice of truth and the voice of Palestinian people is gone. But they are extremely wrong, because Shireen inspired millions of Arabs, Palestinians, non-Palestinians, to still do everything in our power to deliver her message. So they killed her, but her message is still alive in every and single one of us, Arab, non-Arab, everyone who is looking for justice, equality, and dignity for everyone.
Separate investigations by the Associated Press and CNN have both concluded that it was Israeli forces who shot dead the Palestinian-American Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Aqla 2 weeks ago in the occupied West Bank. Abu Aqla was one of the best-known TV journalists in the Middle East. CNN reports it's obtained evidence suggesting Abu Aqla was killed in a targeted attack by Israeli forces. CNN reports, quote, there was no active combat nor any Palestinian militants near Abu Aqla in the moments leading up to her death, unquote. The Israeli military has responded saying that, quote, the claim that the shooting was intentional has no basis, they said.
My first knowledge of Shireen was actually her voice, which is pretty fitting because she is known to be a voice for the Palestinian people and the Palestinian struggle.
So many young, aspiring journalists, especially female journalists, have told me that they would use a hairbrush. They would pretend it were a microphone, and they would stand in front of a mirror and pretend to be Shireen, and they would do the sign off, Shireen Abu Aqla Al Jazeera.
Shireen Abu Aqla Al Jazeera, Al Aghwar.
It was in my 20s that I watched Shireen on TV. It was during the Intifada years. She was kind of the face and voice of a daily digest of war and peace.
I was leaning towards journalism, and I remember seeing her on the air her first year and listening. And I'll never forget my dad basically saying to me, yep, journalism is absolutely the right decision. He said to me, can you imagine what can be accomplished and what can be done if more Palestinian women, you know, got into the field of journalism?
In the field, she was very calm. She had this calm, commanding presence. Israeli soldiers would like lob tear gas at her and other journalists, and you know, everybody would run for cover, and she would kind of duck ever so slightly.
Every single time I watched a Shireen Abu Akleh live report, I learned something new every time. Much of the world was quite ignorant to what was happening in Palestine, in the occupied territories. At the time, it was a trailblazing kind of journalism.
Shireen was so down to earth, shy at times even, that I think that was one of the reasons why Palestinians welcomed her into their home.
Mainstream media uses the words clashes and conflict. She wasn't about that. You know, she told the truth.
She would cover stories that producers would tell her, oh, Shireen, you're too senior for this. How about, you know, we give it to one of the other reporters? And she's like, no, I want to do this. But that doesn't mean that she took things for granted or that she put herself in harm's way. She said that's why she never left anything up to chance. She always had her vest on with the word press on it. She had her helmet. She would also always make sure that, you know, she would take roads where there were no Israeli checkpoints. She knew her stuff and she knew not to put herself in harm's way.
Somebody was interviewing her and they asked her, you know, aren't you afraid of, like, you know, being shot by Israelis or being caught in the line of fire or something like that? And she said, of course I'm afraid. You know, who wouldn't be afraid? But when you're in that moment, you forget that you're afraid of anything because you're seeking the truth.
When I met her, she was completely different off screen, and she was super funny. She loved to have a laugh.
I think she will be remembered as, you know, the daughter of Jerusalem. She will be remembered as an icon, as a leader, as a fighter for truth and for the Palestinian people.
Shireen Abu Akleh, Shireen, كيف تتطور الأمور لحد الآن?
She wanted to tell the story of the people of Palestine. Like, I hope Shireen will always be remembered as somebody who touched the lives of every single person who she spoke to.
Palestine never broke her. It never stopped her from appreciating and enjoying life. A generation of young Arab women looked up to her because, you know, she was the first female correspondent they'd seen on their TV who covered a war. And she covered it with poise and with a lot of confidence, but also, you know, with a lot of humility.
As a Palestinian, it's just so important for me to be in this field and to create change and use my voice, just as Shireen had. What she has inspired is, you know, future generations of journalists to say enough is enough. We need to report this accurately and fairly. She wouldn't want us to stop, so we're not going to.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
It's finally time to bring back smiles, all of them. Shy smiles, carefree smiles, ear-to-ear pearly white flashers, polite smiles, nervous smiles, knowing smiles, and kind smiles. Wearing a mask is no longer mandatory in Quebec, except on public transit, in healthcare facilities, and in the days following your isolation period if you had COVID-19. Feel free to keep wearing one if you feel the need, and do it with a smile. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Touch you, I cannot move. Got me thinking.